The following program is produced by COVID, Race, and Democracy.
Welcome to Pacifica Radio's special broadcast, Black History in the Making, Reclaiming Our Past, Redefining Our Future. This show is presented by Pacifica Radio's COVID, Race, and Democracy and the Pacifica COVID Task Force. Stay with us.
Welcome to Pacifica Radio's special broadcast, Black History in the Making, Reclaiming Our Past, Redefining Our Future. I'm your host, Esther Ivarum of On the Ground, Voices of Resistance from the nation's capital in Washington, D.C. Well, from the January 6th mob attack on the U.S. Capitol to the efforts at Black voter suppression to ongoing resistance to murder and assaults by police, today's news and controversies have deep roots in Black history. On February 16, 2021, Representative Benny Thompson of Mississippi filed a lawsuit against former President Donald Trump, Trump's former lawyer Rudy Giuliani, the hate group the Proud Boys, and the far-right militia group the Oath Keepers. Thompson, joined by the NAACP, claims that actions of both men and both organizations on January 6th violated the 1871 Ku Klux Klan Act, which prohibits any action designed to keep members of Congress from fulfilling their duties. Why there was a need for a Ku Klux Klan Act goes to the heart of this show. The national uprising against racism after the May 2020 murder of George Floyd by Minneapolis police was also a reckoning with the history of racism, and that reckoning often led to the least explored but most consequential era of American history, and that is the era of Reconstruction, the years after the Civil War from 1865 to 1876. Reconstruction was a time of miracles and terror. While the African population, newly freed from slavery, would beat the odds to build their families and communities, they were met with brutality from whites in the South determined to thwart them. A report released in June 2020 by the Equal Justice Initiative titled Reconstruction in America, Racial Violence After the Civil War, 1865 to 1876, documents just the known 2,000 murders of African-American men, women, and children during that decade, as well as brutal assaults and rapes described by witnesses as savage and depraved, including burnings at the stake, forced drownings, severed ears and entrails, mutilated and castrated sex organs, and the open display of skulls and limbs as trophies. The report, which can be read, downloaded, and purchased at EJI.org, concludes that because whites, including police and other paid public officials, were allowed to commit heinous crimes against Black people with impunity, with no consequences during this decade, it set the tone for continued barbaric acts and the denial of basic human and constitutional rights for Black people until the Civil Rights Movement 80 years later. A key target for the terror was to prevent Black people from voting. The formerly enslaved formed the majority in many jurisdictions and were able to elect representatives at the state level and the federal level in Congress. And the same threat of violence to voters was threatened against these legislators and legislative bodies. Hence the 1871 Ku Klux Klan Act, to prevent mob violence and vigilante violence from disrupting the democratic process. So the first part of this show includes my interview with Natan Elaine Kemp, author of There's Something About Edgefield, a book that takes a look at Edgefield, South Carolina, considered ground zero for this war that occurred after the Civil War in this country. Then we're off to the halls of Congress, where in 2020 debate grew over the removal of monuments to the Confederacy, to the slaveocracy, and most of these were erected well after the Civil War. And if you ever wonder why, until this day, Blacks make up such a sizable portion of South Carolina's population and Democratic base, it is because South Carolina, namely Charleston, was the first major port of entry for Africans brought to what became the United States. And nearly 100 years before Africans were brought to Jamestown, Virginia, in 1526, enslaved Africans were part of a Spanish expedition to what is now South Carolina. Those Africans launched a rebellion in November of that same year, and the Spanish could not sustain the settlement, which they abandoned a year later. And that brings me to Natan Elaine Kemp, co-author of There's Something About Edgefield, which includes her research into the American roots of her family, which had been enslaved in Edgefield, South Carolina, and continued to reside there in the first decades after the Civil War. Natan is a native Washingtonian, and inspired by her mother's trips to Abbeville County, South Carolina during the 1990s to learn more about her maternal line, Natan began researching her paternal line in 2001. Both of her paternal grandparents were born in Edgefield County, South Carolina. She's a family historian, researching ancestors from the District of Columbia, Abbeville, Edgefield, and McCormick counties in South Carolina, and Brunswick, Carolin, Hanover, and Louisa counties in Virginia. She's a 2010 graduate of the National Institute on Genealogical Records, now known as the Genealogical Institute on Federal Records. And from 2011 to 2013, she served as editor of Home Place, the official newsletter of the Old Edgefield District African American Genealogical Society. Welcome, Natan.
Thank you. It's great to be here.
Well, until I read your book, I had no idea about Edgefield. So in the decades after the Civil War, Black people were routinely murdered, abused, burned from their homes by whites. They are determined to violently reject their claim to equal citizenship and their humanity. So most of us know about Jim Crow terror existing throughout the South, the Deep South, and might give Mississippi the crown for that type of terror. But what is the something about Edgefield, South Carolina? And did you always know about it, or did you find out about it while researching your family history?
It was the latter. I did not know about Edgefield County until I started researching my family history. My paternal grandparents were both born in Edgefield County. What is it about Edgefield? In the title, there is something about Edgefield. In 1860, Edgefield County had the sixth highest enslaved population in the United States. You may have heard of Representative Preston Brooks Hukane, Senator Charles Sumner on the Senate floor in the early 1850s. Preston Brooks was the congressional representative from Edgefield County. South Carolina, people outside the state always think of Charleston, may think of a few other locations. But during antebellum time period, it was the areas of Edgefield District, as it was known at the time, and Abbeville District, where Vice President John C. Calhoun were from. Those areas were the powerhouse of the states, and those areas were very pro-slavery, very dominant in terms of how they exerted power in the state of South Carolina and shaped policy throughout the state.
There was a portion in your book when you talk about Edgefield's ugly history, and you talk about the Black codes. And when you wrote that, the editor of a newspaper in Edgefield announced that if Congress failed to allow the proposed Black codes compelling the Negro to labor, the only option was to keep the freedmen from becoming landowners. The editor called for a tax of $1,000 to $5,000 upon every white man who sells, rents, gives, loans, or in any way conveys to a Negro any tract, parcel, or acreage of land. Fortunately, Congress quickly responded by passing the Civil Rights Act of 1866, which made it illegal to discriminate against the freedmen by assigning them an inferior legal or economic status. On July 9, 1868, the states ratified the 14th Amendment, which guaranteed equal protection of the laws to residents of every state. Despite this, a freedman testified to the Freedmen's Bureau that it was, quote, dangerous for a Black man to live in the Edgefield District, South Carolina, because white men were murdering the freedmen. So that seems to say it all to me. From your book, there's something about Edgefield. And when I think about the white men murdering the freedmen, meaning, you know, black men at that time, or black women also, it brings me back to today, because I thought that despite the chaos and real trauma that we're all experiencing right now in our country, I thought that the history that you provide in your book relates directly to today in terms of the young people out in the streets protesting the murder of George Floyd. And I wanted to know, before we get back to some of the things that you discovered in your research, how you see today's events. I think you have a certain insight relating that history from Edgefield to today.
First, I want to give credit that that section of the book was written by my late co-author, Edna Gale Bush. Her great-grandfather, Albert Bush, was part of 2% of blacks who were able to acquire land in Edgefield after the Civil War. In the book, I talk about Ida B. Wells and what she says in a red record, alleged causes of lynching. She mentions Edgefield by name. Blacks were killed just because they attempted to exercise their right to vote. And you ask, what is it about Edgefield? I want to mention that at the time after the Civil War, so in early Reconstruction, there is a person by the name of Lawrence Kane. He gives an account about the number of eligible voters at the time of June 1868, just before the presidential election. There were 4,990-something eligible black voters, of course, all men. And there were only about 2,569 eligible white male voters. Blacks could control things politically just by their vote because they outnumbered the whites. And I think people tend to forget that. And let me also mention, what is it about Edgefield? Edgefield District/County, because it became a county in 1868, was the only place in South Carolina where the presidential election of 1868 was not held. So everywhere else in South Carolina, blacks, recently freed blacks, were able to vote, but not in Edgefield. Unfortunately, what is happening today has happened periodically throughout African American experience in the United States. It is not new. It is not shocking. Maybe for those who don't know history, but for those who spent time delving into either their family history or studying the history of a particular area or the United States, you're going to come across this.
And I think the massacres of black people occurred around their attempt to vote. Do you want to tell us about those?
I think in the book we mentioned the Hamburg Massacre, which is one, and that received a lot of attention. That was even discussed in the halls of Congress, that particular massacre. And it started off in a sort of a minor dispute. You had blacks who were, I think, preparing for a march. These were soldiers around the time of the 4th of July for independence. And there were a couple of white farmers who were trying to travel along the road, and there was an argument that started. Basically, I think you had one white farmer killed, or a white resident killed, but a number of blacks were killed. And it all started with just this tension between these white farmers who were probably a little irritated with these blacks who they see walking around with rifles. There is another massacre that's mentioned in the, I believe it is in the introduction, that is written by Elaine Roundtree.
But before you get to that one, though, so what happened at the end of the Hamburg? I mean, how many black people wound up being killed as a result of this initial skirmish?
I do not recall the exact numbers that were killed. I just remember that it was, it received a lot of attention, right, because it was viewed as a massacre, right, not a riot. And that's something I wanted to add, too, in discussion with what's going on in today's event. There is an African proverb that states, until lions become their own historians, every story will glorify the hunter. And we need to tell our stories, because presented from a non-Black perspective, sometimes what occurred in Hamburg is described as a riot,
right,
versus a massacre. Right. And it's who's telling the story.
Okay.
Let me say where Hamburg was located, because it doesn't exist today. Hamburg was on the border of Augusta, Georgia. Hamburg was like an early Tulsa, Oklahoma. So after the war, you had a lot of Blacks who wanted to leave behind tilling of the land. And you had a society to develop with your lawyers and your bankers, your judges, people who opened up their own businesses, people who got away from the agriculture. They built a society. And part of that, what happened in Hamburg, which was, you would think, just a minor like dispute on the road, there was this tension because whites disliked these Blacks who had managed to, after freedom, develop their own societies and succeed.
Just to give the audience a better understanding, in 1868, Edgefield changed political names in terms of what the state did. They changed it from a district to a county. Hamburg was part of Edgefield County in 1868, but I believe it was in March of 1871, Aiken County was formed, and Hamburg became part of Aiken County at that point and was no longer part of Edgefield. But when Hamburg started to thrive post-Civil War, and I'm looking at a book called The Bloody Shirt, Terror After the Civil War by Stephen Badansky. He mentioned specifically regarding Hamburg, within a few years, the town was home to hundreds of colored families who had broken free of the life of contracted farm workers, a life scarcely distinguishable from slavery. Among their numbers were school teachers, railroad employees, blacksmiths, a successful cotton broker, a printer, a clerk of the court, shoemakers, painters, carpenters, a constable. They bought lots and furnished homes. There were several who made considerable investments in farms and other real estate in South Carolina and states beyond. So Hamburg quickly became a thriving middle class and, for a few, sort of upper class place to live. They were able to throw off their old life as being farmers and to be able to prosper economically. And what you have similar to Tulsa is whites did not like that. They wanted Blacks under their foot. They didn't want to see Blacks achieve to assert their independence, to prove that they could do things on their own. They didn't depend on whites to be able to not only make a living, but to excel.
That is the voice of author Natan Elaine Kemp, and we're talking about her book, There Is Something About Edgefield. This is Pacifica Radio. Stay with us.
Mastered economics, cause you took yourself from squalor. Slave. Mastered academics, cause your grace said you were scholar. Slave. Mastered Instagram, cause you can instigate a follow. Look at all these slave masters posing on your dollar. Get it?
Look at all these slave masters posing on your dollar.
Get it?
Look at all these slave masters posing on your dollar.
Get it?
Look at all these slave masters posing on your dollar.
Get it?
Look at all these slave masters.
Spending time, I'm on mine, I be minding mine. Every time, on my grind, I'm just trying to shine. Make a dollar, government, they want a dozen dime. The petty kind might kill you cause they see you shine. I done had to have a talk with myself many times. Am I a hypocrite cause I know I did plenty crime. I get broke too many times, I might slang some pine. You believe corporations running marijuana. Your country again ran by a casino owner. Ooh, pedophile sponsor all these racist bastards. And I told you once before that you should kill your master. Now that's the line that's probably gonna get my ass up.
Master of these politics, you swear that you got options. Master of opinion, cause you vote with the white collar. The 13th Amendment says that slavery's abolished.
Look at all these slave masters posing on your dollar. Get it?
Look at all these slave masters posing on your dollar. Get it? Look at all these slave masters posing on your dollar.
You're listening. listening to Black History in the Making, Reclaiming Our Past, Redefining Our Future. This show is presented by Pacifica Radio's COVID, Race, and Democracy and the Pacifica COVID Task Force.
Stay tuned for more of COVID, Race, and Democracy.
I'm Esther Evarim in conversation with author Natan Elaine Kemp about her book, There Is Something About Edgefield. And before the break, Natan, we were talking about that period right after the Civil War when there were so many tensions between newly freed African people who were succeeding despite the tremendous odds against them and the backlash that they face from whites who did not want to see them do well, and the tremendous violence and even assaults and murder perpetrated against the Black population in Edgefield, South Carolina, a notoriously violent place. It kind of reminds me of the eulogy, the sermon that the Reverend Al Sharpton gave at the memorial for George Floyd, when he just talked about white folks having their knee on our neck, not just in Floyd's killing, but for these so many centuries. Now, I'm seeing another part in the book where, and I think this is here you were talking about that same time, it says, with every passing decade after the Civil War ended, restrictions on Blacks worsened. I think you were talking about the Black codes at that point. For example, while No, this is Edna Gale Bush speaking about her ancestors, and she's saying,
yes,
while my great-grandfather Alfred was able to vote in 1868, by 1904, my grandfather Albert could not. The stripping of rights began after the Hamburg riot. See my co-author's chapter for details. She's talking about you.
Yes.
And the election of Wade Hampton in 1876. A participant in the riot, he's talking about the Hamburg riot, and future governor and senator of South Carolina, Edgefield native Benjamin Ryan Tillman stated, quote, we have done our level best to prevent Blacks from voting, and we have scratched our heads to find out how we could eliminate the last one of them. We stuffed ballot boxes, we shot them, we are not ashamed of it, end quote. So that's in the book. So I know that that was one incident. You chronicle so many interesting and just, I don't know, just a real horrific history there. And when you were doing your research, how did you first discover the connection between how voting was used to suppress the population?
Once I had exhausted what I could in terms of researching my direct line, I decided to look more broadly in Edgefield, where they live, to get a sense of what things were like for the Black population. I have no writings from my ancestors, no journals, diaries, so I had to turn to what was happening more broadly to get a sense. And as I studied Edgefield, going through the local newspapers, looking at congressional testimony regarding disputed elections during Reconstruction or violence during Reconstruction, I stumbled across the fact that no one was able to vote for the president in 1868 in Edgefield County. And number two, I came across the fact that the 1876 election, which I think from a national perspective, a lot of us know was very important in the history of the United States, Edgefield, or actually the state of South Carolina, was one of those battlegrounds in terms of maintaining the efforts during Reconstruction versus the reassertion of white dominance and white power, particularly in the South. And Edgefield happened to be ground zero because the plan that allowed whites to regain power politically in South Carolina was known as the Edgefield Plan.
Mm.
So Edgefield was the epicenter. And Lawrence Kane was at ground zero trying to resist all of that.
What was the Edgefield Plan? Was it just basically intimidation, violence, and murder? I mean,
basically, by any means necessary to suppress the Black vote.
Right.
That including threatening
Black citizens, that included murdering Black citizens, that including whites voting more than once, that including allowing whites from Augusta, Georgia, which is on the border with Edgefield County, to come over and vote in Edgefield. They are stuffing ballot boxes. You have a group known as the Red Shirts. It's not exactly the same as the Ku Klux Klan, but they shared some traits with them. But this was a group, the Red Shirts, that proudly represented their interests, the interests of the Confederacy, even though they lost. And they did what they could to suppress the vote. For instance, I think I recount in the book where some Black voters attempted to vote, but you had whites on horses with their pistols and their red shirts standing around the polling center, preventing Blacks from actually reaching the polls to vote.
Right. I read the quote from, I think it was a member of Congress who just said very boldly and proudly, like, you know, we have done our best to basically keep Black people from voting. And he wasn't shy about it. Now, Nathan, you were going to tell me about how this related to some passages in The Virtue of Cain also.
Yes, but first I wanted to follow up with what you just asked about the quote. The individual you were referring to was Benjamin, nicknamed Pitchfork Tillman.
Yeah.
He was governor and later served as a U.S. senator representing South Carolina. So, absolutely no regrets. It was something that they had to do to maintain power. Just to give you an example, I gave you the count in terms of registered voters in Edgefield in 1868, Black versus whites. Just to give you another example, to give you an idea, Blacks outnumbered whites in Edgefield. In 1860, with the 1860 census, Edgefield County was the sixth largest enslaved county in the United States.
Wow, this is 1860?
1860. So that's the, you know, that's the last sort of population you have officially before the Civil War.
Right.
And then by 1870, they're freed. So you have to go with 1860 as the closest state you have to that, the size of the enslaved population in Edgefield.
So the other thing that really stood out for me was your work and your skill as a researcher of your family history. And, you know, as someone who has done just a little bit of that on my own, I was really struck by how the advent, I guess, of DNA testing has made such an impact on that history. Most of us who are African American, who are researching our history, we hit certain roadblocks, but DNA testing, many of us are maybe working with that in terms of some of these kits that you can get mailed to you and tells you about your genealogical background and whatever. But it also can tell you about your relatives, and people are finding family that they didn't even know about. So in terms of researching our roots of our enslaved ancestors, it's also letting us know very often who the European, usually the European male ancestor is, who raped an enslaved woman or a girl, and then she bared his child.
That's correct. I believe my co-author and her chapters was able to reveal that information and how, through DNA testing, she was able to connect the dots. It is important to say that you still have to do the research, because you can get DNA results, and unless someone is like a first or second cousin, you may not be able to just quickly determine how you're related to that individual. Now, in reading my book, you may recall that in Chapter 4, I profile someone by the name of Columbus Blair, or C.L. Blair. He was involved in a killing of someone during the height of Reconstruction. I didn't have it at the time that I submitted the manuscript, but after the manuscript was submitted, DNA testing basically has revealed that, like I suspected, he sired my second great-grandfather, Nathaniel Blair.
Wow. The other part of this whole DNA issue for me is the fact that you can reach out to people, and it's interesting that some are interested in understanding the relationship there and accepting it, and other people are really hostile to the idea of that information being brought to them, even if it's just scientifically proven on the paper.
Yes, you will encounter that. I would caution people to don't react. If they don't respond, hopefully they won't send anything nasty. Usually what you may have is someone will initially respond and then, you know, they won't continue the conversation after that. I've had that experience. But let me say that it's not just whites who may disbelieve that there's any way they could be related to you as a black person. You have other blacks who may not want to talk, and there may be stories they've been told, maybe realities they don't want to face. So I want to say that it encompasses all individuals in terms of how sometimes people react to learning that, oh my goodness, why are you so close to me? How could we be first or second cousins?
Right, exactly. I mean, that can go up to current living situations, like, you know, whose father, who's, you know, whatever.
Right? Exactly.
Exactly, yeah. Well,
I would say there is that issue, because race is such an issue in this country that sometimes folks just can't even handle a discussion regarding, well, we appear, based on the DNA results, to be connected. Let's try to work together to try to determine. Or could you help me out because you have more likely a complete genealogy versus what I have.
Right. Right.
And some people are open and willing to help, and some are not. And so it's hit or miss. I can't tell you how someone's going to react.
Right, right. But I do want to spend a little time so that you can offer our listeners some advice on beginning or continuing research into their family history. When I was reading your bio, it said a few things that were familiar to me. Like, for example, one of the articles that you wrote was Stumbling Without the 1890 Census. And I think that's because that's the year that the census burned, right?
Yes. It was a fire at the Commerce Building in 1921.
Right. And then Overcoming the Brick Wall of Slavery. So I know that those of us who are African American who have tried to research our histories, you do feel like you hit this wall, because it's not like you can kind of find regular records, you know, and so I know you can't get into either of those in depth, but just give us maybe one tip that you think is helpful for anyone beginning to research their family history.
A tip would be, when you start off, make sure you collect as much information as you can on your parents, their siblings, your grandparents, your great grandparents. Get all that information first. Right. And then go to the census. Start off with the 1940 census and work your way back chronologically every 10 years. The issue is the 1890 census, so you will have a gap of 20 years between 1900 and 1880. But first, work your way back to 1870. And then what you need to do, if you can, is you want to try to fill the gap in that 20-year time period. And this is where vital records are important. So you want to get birth, marriage, and death records if you can. Also check, depending on the location, there may be more resources either at the state or local level. There are local census records, there are tax records, land transactions, voter registration. Of course, that's only going to be males. You want to look also at church records. I'll just quickly state that for South Carolina, for Baptist records, Furman University is the repository for all South Carolina Baptist church records. And depending on the location and the church and what remains, you may have extensive records, even going back to slavery, where they name the slaves. Sometimes slaves are baptized, that's recorded. Slaves are excommunicated for certain things that they've done. So you can have that type of detail. So don't overlook that. And also, you want to look at wills of slave owners. So there's a variety of records that you can look at to get information. And I want to also mention
that it's going to vary, again, state to state. So a state like South Carolina doesn't have as much detailed records if you are not from places like Charleston or Edgefield. Charleston has the best records. Edgefield has the second best archival collection in the state. In contrast, Virginia has a wealth of records, and they have a register going back to, I believe, 1853, registers of births and deaths in the Commonwealth.
So is there going to be a second part to this? I found it almost like a mystery. I was so absorbed reading this. You know, I read at night, so like I would just strain to the edge of my being able to stay awake to keep reading. So after you did this very impressive amount of research, and do you have a desire to do more and to do another book?
Yes. Let me answer this in two parts. First, number one, I am not only an author, but I am a publisher. My company is called Rocky Pond Press. And last August, I published a book titled Virtue of Cain, From Slave to Senator, The Biography of Lawrence Cain. It's written by Kevin M. Cherry Sr., a white man who discovered about 5 to 7 years ago that his second great-grandfather was not part Cherokee, but in fact was black man, very fair skin, from Edgefield District, South Carolina. I happen to mention Lawrence Cain in the book that I co-authored. I think both Gail and I mentioned Lawrence Cain. Just briefly, Lawrence Cain was educated, even though he wasn't supposed to be taught. He was born during slavery. Someone educated him. He accompanied, he was a body servant to a Confederate soldier during the Civil War. He was injured at Appomattox, where Robert E. Lee eventually surrendered. When he returned to Edgefield, he opened up the first school for colored students in 1866. He was a census enumerator in 1870. He joined the government as a state representative, lower house, in 1868. So I just want to mention he's an extraordinary individual. And if someone wants to get into deeper what happened in Edgefield, I mention it, but his book, because he's a direct descendant of this person who was in power and then lost his seat in 1876 when white regained power in South Carolina. So I would mention the book Virtue of Cain, From Slave to Senator, Biography of Lawrence Cain. I will be working on another book, but talking about my Virginia roots. There's a big difference, just in researching, I've noticed, between South Carolina and Virginia versus sort of the upper South and the deep South. There's a big difference. And I like to highlight some of those differences. Those ancestors of mine were landowners, whereas my ancestors in South Carolina and Edgefield were not.
Yeah, I think I saw the beginnings of some of that, you know, toward the end of the book. You mentioning some of that, that was very interesting to me because it's closer here to D.C. and where many of our listeners live, even though we have listeners all over the country and all over the world. But I'm going to have to leave it there. But I've so enjoyed this conversation. I'm sure our listeners want to hear more, especially as you continue your research. I've been speaking with Natan Elaine Kemp, author of There's Something About Edgefield. Thank you for joining me today, Natan.
Thank you.
You're listening to Pacifica Radio's special broadcast, Black History in the Making, Reclaiming Our Past, Redefining Our Future. I'm Esther Evarim in Washington, D.C. Up next, Voices from Congress on those Confederate monuments. Stay with us.
You're listening to Black History in the Making, Reclaiming Our Past, Redefining Our Future. This show is presented by Pacifica Radio's COVID Race and Democracy and the Pacifica COVID Task Force.
Stay tuned for more of COVID Race and Democracy.
Thank you, Chairwoman Holland and Ranking Member Curtis. I want to thank also Chairman Grijalva for having me here today and for including H.R. 970, the Robert E. Lee Statue Removal Act, as part of today's legislative hearing. I also want to thank my colleagues, Congresswoman Norton and Congressman McEachin, for their work on this issue. We're all incredibly proud of our national parks and public lands. They preserve the natural landscapes and represent part of the intricate tapestry of our national history. And that history can be painful. Yet we are reminded that we have not had an honest accounting of that history. And for too long, we've been blind to the way past injustices continues to shape the present. The question before us today is straightforward. Do Confederate flags and monuments have any place in our national parks? To answer this question, I simply ask myself what these statutes and symbols commemorate. The glorification of the Confederacy, its traitorous leaders, their cause of slavery and open rebellion against the United States of America. In my mind, there is only one side in the Civil War we should be honoring, the United States, and all those Americans in both the North and South who fought against those who tried to divide our country and perpetuate a system of systemic oppression and racial subjugation. And therefore, it is time for these monuments to come down. These statues and monuments were built in the late 19th and early 20th centuries by Confederate apologists, segregationists, and opponents of civil rights. They recast Confederate soldiers as heroes fighting for a supposed lost cause and celebrated their traitorous leaders. And the heyday of monument building, a period that began in 1890 and spanned to 1920, was also a time of extreme racial violence. Violence that we saw again during the 1960s and 1970s when white Southerners pushed back against what little progress had been made by Black Americans. As monuments went up, Black men, women, and children were being lynched. The Confederate monument served as a reminder of the power that white supremacists could and would exert over Black bodies. These monuments became beacons of white supremacy and symbols of an effort to intimidate Black Americans into seeing themselves as inferior and less than. These monuments do nothing to teach us of the dark lessons of our history, but are the very center of the white supremacist racist imagination. My bill would remove but one of many such works from federal land. This statue of Robert E. Lee on Antietam Battlefield, the place where more Americans died in a single day, was commissioned with the explicit intent of honoring the Confederacy and built in 2003, 138 years after the end of the Civil War. The 24-foot statue of Lee is not historically accurate, and despite an inscription stating otherwise, honors a man who fought to preserve the institution of slavery.
Thank you, Mr. Brown. The chair now recognizes the gentlelady from the District of Columbia, Ms. Norton.
Thank you, Madam Chair, for holding this hearing. I thank your fellow committee members, and I thank your fellow panelists. I also thank you for allowing me to testify on my bill to permanently remove the statue of Confederate General Albert Pike from federal land near Judiciary Square in the nation's capital. This statute was authorized not by the District of Columbia, but by Congress in 1898 when the district had no home rule, that is to say, self-government authority. The statute was constructed using both federal and private funds. The Freemasons, of which Pike was a member, donated the money, or much of it, needed to build and install the statute in 1901. The Freemasons themselves support the statute's removal. I've written with them, and they say, given its divisive nature, it's time for it to go. Although the statue was taken down last month during a demonstration, President Trump reportedly has called for the statue to be put back up. I believe Confederate statues should be placed in museums valuable historical artifacts when combined with the story of their meaning in our history. Pike was a Confederate general who served dishonorably and was forced to resign in disgrace. It was found that soldiers under his command mutilated the bodies of Union soldiers, and Pike was ultimately imprisoned after his fellow officers reported that he had misappropriated funds, adding to the dishonor of taking up arms against the United States. Pike dishonored even his Confederate military service. He certainly has no claim to be memorialized in the nation's capital. Madam Chair, I appreciate the hearing. I strongly urge my colleagues to support this legislation. Thank you again.
Thank you, Ms. Norton. I thank the sponsoring members of Congress for their valuable testimony. Now we will transition to our second panel. The chair now recognizes Reverend Robert Wright Lee, descendant of the Confederate General Robert E. Lee.
I am not the first Robert Lee to testify before the United States Congress. One did in 1866 during Reconstruction. It is indeed another person who bears a first and surname identical to mine, and whose lineage I bear as a nephew of Confederate General Robert E. Lee. But I've been clear that I dare not speak for my entire family or for even the general himself, as some still revere him and see no reason for this hearing today. I will instead let the famed Confederate soldier speak for himself, as his documented testimony before Congress can be found easily in your records. When asked before Congress and the country if black American citizens were equally capable of acquiring knowledge as white Americans, that, Robert Lee said, I do not think that he is capable of acquiring knowledge as the white man is. There are some more apt than others. I have known some to acquire knowledge and skill in their trade or profession. I've had servants of my own who learned to read and write very well. Lee was later asked by a senator from Missouri during the same hearing if Southern states should allow the suffrage of black Americans. Lee remarked, "My own opinion is that at this time they cannot vote intelligently, and that giving them the right of suffrage would open the door to great deals of demagogism and lead to embarrassments in various ways." I raise these two statements and moments from the other Robert Lee's testimony to highlight the difference and dissonance from what this Robert Lee is about to say. I fully believe, along with a host of other amazing citizens of this great country, that black lives matter. And for us to continue to celebrate a man who questioned the education, disparaged the right to vote of black life, and had previously fought for the continued enslavement of Africans on the North American continent is an affront to those now who are suffering under current weights of oppression. If we are honest, the answer is clear. We cannot remain complicit with these monuments. We cannot remain silent anymore. If we do so, our silence becomes agreement and endorsement to complicity. The statue at Antietam and the bill that it represents and statues everywhere must be removed for a more perfect union, which is inclusive of a better tomorrow and a better United States.
Thank you very much, Reverend Lee. The chair now recognizes the Honorable Mitch Landrieu, founder of E Pluribus Unum and former mayor of the city of New Orleans.
Thank you, Madam Chairperson and Ranking Member Curtis. As many of you know, as mayor of New Orleans, I removed four Confederate statues from public land with a process that started in 2015 and ended in May of 2017 with the removal of a Robert E. Lee statue from the city's most prominent circle. That process helped reintroduce historical facts and a more proper telling of the history of how and why many of these statues and monuments were put up in the first place. The historic record is now clear. Statues of Confederate leaders were erected not just to honor these men, but as part of a movement which has now become known as the Cult of the Lost Cause. This lost cause had one goal, through monuments and other means, to rewrite history, to hide the truth, which is that the Confederacy was on the wrong side of humanity. It sought to continue to oppress black Americans and black lives. According to the work of the Southern Poverty Law Center, there are some 700 Confederate memorial monuments and statues erected well after the Civil War. There are 1,000 streets, buildings, and other markers named after Confederate leaders. In summary, the South lost the war, and a group of people got together and decided that they were going to adorn the country with monuments that revered those who fought on behalf of a cause that was lost, which they wanted to make seem noble. It was a propaganda campaign of epic proportions. You see, these statues are not just stone and metal. They're not just innocent remembrances of a benign history. These monuments purposefully celebrate and perpetuate a fictional, sanitized Confederacy, ignoring the death, the enslavement, and the terror that they actually stood for. Ultimately, as a country, we must grapple with a simple notion. There is a difference between remembrance of history and the reverence of it. So let me close with a plea to our collective humanity. I noted in a speech upon removing the monuments that a friend had asked me to consider these monuments from the perspective of an African-American mother or father trying to explain to their fifth grade daughter who Robert E. Lee is and why he is revered with this statue. Can any of you look into this child's eyes and convince her that Robert E. Lee is there to encourage her? Do you think that she will feel inspired and hopeful? Do these monuments help her see a future with limitless potential? Have you ever thought that if her potential is limited, ours is too? We all know the answers to these very simple questions. When you look into this child's eyes is the moment when the searing truth comes into focus. This is the moment when we know what is right and what we must do. We cannot continue to walk away from this truth. We must remove all these Confederate symbols that dirty the soil of our beloved country. Once that is done, we can better confront the racist systems that have divided us by design from the beginning of our beloved country for generations, so that we can get closer to be the more perfect union that we all aspire to be. Thank you so much.
That was the voice of former Mayor of New Orleans, Mitch Landrieu, speaking Tuesday, July 21st, 2020, at the House Natural Resources Subcommittee on National Parks. The hearing was on the removal of Confederate statues on public land. Before him, the Reverend Robert W. Lee IV, a descendant of Confederate General Robert E. Lee, and sponsors of proposed legislation, Representative Eleanor Holmes Norton of Washington, D.C., and Representative Anthony Brown of Maryland. A bit of an epilogue on that hearing. A statue of Confederate General Robert E. Lee was removed from the U.S. Capitol National Statuary Hall in December. It had represented Virginia in the U.S. Capitol for 111 years. But other statues of Confederate leaders placed in the hall by Southern states remain. That proposed law by Representative Anthony Brown of Maryland to remove the statue of Confederate General Robert E. Lee from the Antietam National Battlefield won approval in the U.S. House in December of 2020 and was sent to the Senate for possible consideration. But the law would need to be reconsidered in the current session of Congress. On Juneteenth, 2020, demonstrators in D.C. pulled down the statue of Confederate General Albert Pike and set it on fire. Former President Trump said that he wanted the Pike statue restored and reinstalled, but it has not been reinstalled as of this recording in February 2021. This concludes today's special broadcast, Black History in the Making, Reclaiming Our Past, Redefining Our Future. I'm Esther Averam in Washington, D.C. Thank you for listening, and remember that so many of today's news stories and controversies have deep roots in Black history. Peace.
This is Black History in the Making, Reclaiming Our Past, Redefining Our Future. The show you just heard was produced in collaboration with the Pacifica COVID Task Force, the production team of COVID Race and Democracy, Pacifica Network stations, and affiliates throughout the country. Our engineer is John Miller. Our production editors are Paulina Vasiliev, Lona Alliance, and Akua Holt, along with our media intern, Akono Kamau. Fahima Sack is our line producer. Steve Zelter and Akua Holt are the executive producers. Our theme music by the godfather of Afrobeat, Fela Anikalapo Kuti. water, no get enemy. Special thanks to Knitting Factory Records and Lydia Bazone, Interim Executive Director of the Pacifica Network. Listen to this and other programs online and discover more about COVID, race, and democracy at covidtaskforce.pacifica.org, covidtaskforce.pacifica.org. Thank you for listening.